Hello and welcome to Music Works, a podcast by Polyphony Arts. We're talking about the future of the classical music industry with some great guests. Thank you for joining us.
Hello and welcome to Music Works, a podcast by Polyphony Arts. I'm Katie Beardsworth, the founder of Polyphony Arts, and today I'm talking to Hannah Fiddy, the co-founder of Alternative Classical. Hi, Hannah.
Hello.
Hello, welcome.
Thank you.
Hannah, tell us about Alternative Classical and what you do.
Hello everyone. I am the co-founder of Alternative Classical, which is all about creating and promoting new ways of approaching classical music. So it encompasses quite a few different things. We've just announced that we are an artist agency, so we are now managing four artists and also a project, which is a very nice thing to come out of lockdown. But we've got many different strands going on as well. So we have an interview page on our site. We have an events guide to all the weird and wacky classical things going on around the UK in interesting venues. I've got an article series. Every Friday I've got a jobs and opportunities thread for things happening in the classical industry. So Alternative Classical is many things. And as well as doing that, I'm a classical music consultant, and I'm currently working with John Rutter, managing his digital presence and his marketing. So that was long-winded.
Such a range of things. How fabulous. Well, I've been aware of Alternative Classical for a while now, following what you do. As anyone who kind of follows what Polyphony Arts does will know, I'm also very keen on alternative ways of presenting classical music. And you know, finding audiences finding music that they didn't think they might have otherwise liked because of it. So let's talk about what we mean by alternative classical music, and perhaps therefore what the alternative, would you say, is traditional classical music?
It's a good question. I suppose alternative can mean lots of different things and does mean a lot of different things to whoever I speak to. So one way I think about it is that classical music is very often presented in a concert hall, where the performers are on stage and the audience is watching, and you sit there for a couple of hours and you enjoy perhaps an overture, a concerto, a symphony, and there may be an interval in that. Generally it starts at 7:30 p.m. There are lots of different ways of presenting classical music. The sitting in a concert hall and listening to the traditional presentation, that's one way. But there's also this massive wave of artists and organizations finding alternative venues, non-traditional venues, spaces, taking classical music outside, presenting it in different formats, putting pieces together in different ways. So thinking about how we program imaginatively, just creating lots of different experiences to attract different kinds of audiences.
Great.
So does that sum up?
It certainly does. And can you give us a couple of examples of really alternative classical music presentation?
So One example would be organisations such as Non-Classical, who I used to work for, who are putting on contemporary classical music with electronics in pubs and clubs. And it's presented very much more like a gig. So everyone is standing, there's drinks, people are kind of going in and out as they please. You don't necessarily need to turn up exactly at 7:30. There's DJ sets in between the various sets. The sets tend to be shorter, the performance sets tend to be shorter. So that would be one example. Another one would be pop-up orchestras. So there's a few of these. There's now one in Scotland called the Nevis Ensemble. There's one in England that I used to work for called Street Orchestra Live. And there's a really well-established one in Amsterdam called the Ricciotti Ensemble. And I think they've been going for about 50 years. And their business model is touring for a few days, going to a city and driving around on a bus. It's really fun. And getting off in lots of different places around that city. So it might be firstly a train station, doing a half hour performance for anyone who happens to be going past, and then going on to a park and playing for whoever's in the park, and then possibly going to a school and doing a workshop with some children. And through that, I've been to all kinds of interesting spaces, whether that's supermarkets. We went to IKEA, I think, B&Q, Tesco, Primark, lots of shops coming up, prison, just so many interesting spaces. So we try and do, say, six concerts a day. And it's the idea is that you're taking music directly to people who may not otherwise think to book to go to a specific concert.
That's fabulous. And did you say is that the one that's been going for 50 years?
So that's the one in Amsterdam that's been
Oh,
in,
right.
that's 50 years,
That's
Ricciotti Ensemble.
fantastic. Yeah.
Yeah, so I think this is
That's really
growing
amazing.
around the world, which is amazing, but it is a really difficult model. I think it's hard in the UK, partly because of the weather. And if you go
Oh, yeah.
to and if you go to a city that doesn't have as many large spaces inside, because if you have to work out how to fit an entire orchestra in there, and the concert presentation is also quite different from perhaps how a traditional orchestra might present themselves. So I think all these orchestras wear whatever they like, so they're not wearing black. They're standing up rather than sitting down, and they tend to choreograph some bits and move around different formations. So you might have a performance where the orchestra is surrounding the audience. And sometimes some of these pieces are learned off copy as well. So that's how you can get the choreography. You've mainly got to learn the music by heart, which is another hurdle. But I know that Aurora Orchestra have done a lot of off copy performances as well.
Well, it's really interesting, isn't it? It's financially bringing music. I mean, that's a bit with my project manager hat on, which never really comes off. That sounds very expensive and logistically complex, to say the least. And so, as you say, business model wise, that's not something that attracts direct ticket income. But then I think that's interesting. I think it's essential that classical music is brought to people and presented in more accessible ways, whether that's to do with cost or direct location or as in like location within a city, but then also venue and how comfortable people feel in venues. And it's great to hear of these things. And how much do you think in the classical world we have sort of various alternative presentations of classical music available to us as against how much there is that's sort of in the traditional format? I don't know if that question makes sense. Like, let's say that you're new to classical music and you're looking at what's going on in a city. Do you think you'd be like almost everything happens at 7:30 in a concert hall, but there's maybe this one thing that doesn't, or do you think it would be more balanced than that?
Yeah, it's an interesting one. And it's partly why I started my events guide, because everything I could read about and everything I heard about seemed to be very traditional. And that was what was being represented in the news, and in various publications. And I just didn't really feel like it represented a lot of the kind of events that I've worked on and that I tend to go to. And I had a lot of people saying to me, "Oh, where did you hear about this amazing event?" And I seemed very clued into it just because I'm really interested in that, obviously, and I was following lots of the artists and organizations that were putting these events on. So I thought, okay, I've got so many people asking me how to find out about these. I'd better just start writing about it and bringing them all together, because there was no one place that you could go to find out about all these amazing things. I definitely sometimes feel like I'm in a bit of a bubble, in that I can end up feeling like everything in the classical industry is now alternative, just because I'm so clued into it. And every day I've got a new person emailing me and saying, "Oh, I'm going to put on this silent opera in a London warehouse," or there's always something coming to me. So it's really exciting for me, because I can see that it's really growing. It's a fast growing strain within the industry. But I also think that it probably still is a relatively small part of the industry, and that most organizations probably are still generally following the traditional model. And some people are embracing it more than others, but I suppose my other answer would be that I don't see the two as being in opposition. I am at all not here to stand up against the traditional side. It's not a kind of either or situation. I just think that there are loads of ways of presenting this amazing music, and I love dreaming up all the different ways that we can do it. But I also understand that in some situations you do want to go to a concert hall and you do want to sit there and listen in silence, and that's lovely as well, and I like to do that. But I would love to support the idea that there are a whole gamut of ways that we can imagine classical music.
Yeah, I completely agree about not seeing the two things as in opposition either. And I think that's part of the reason why I've been pondering the answer to that question, because which you've given so well, which is, you know, the I also feel like I'm in a bit of a bubble in which lots of the people that I sort of connect with professionally are very well versed in alternative presentations and also kind of inclusivity and diversity, which I sort of feel that those two things go hand in hand, I feel, because the traditional concert setting isn't very inclusive, really. Obviously some more so than others, but overall it still excludes a lot of people, unfortunately. And so I suppose having found myself in a bubble of people who deal with a whole range of events, some traditional, some not, I'm kind of wondering to myself how how the industry is in terms of that shift, whether it's becoming more equal or whether it's actually still only 1% of events, and I just happen to be involved in lots of those, if you see what I mean.
And I would also love to know about this, and I'm really interested to see how this develops post lockdown. And I can't figure out whether I think that the more traditional events will end up being the only things that are able to go ahead, just because they're the things that are more funded, and it's easier. Perhaps funding is more readily available for those events. But on the other hand, I think alternative ways of presenting classical music could become a really positive step that we can take. Because, for example, I have been to concerts pre-lockdown, where all the musicians were standing on their individual platforms and the audience were able to roam in between the orchestra. So it was kind of like a surround sound experience. So I think something like that could work really well with distancing. So actually alternative methods could provide a way that we can get classical music back on its feet in some ways.
Yeah, that's interesting, actually. That ties in with, I've got quite a few different ways I want to go with this, actually. But that reminded me of a conversation that I had recently with someone who does programming for an orchestra. And they said that doing socially distanced concerts, which they are doing some in-person socially distanced concerts, was actually very freeing artistically. Because instead of being desperate to get 400 people through the door, you were maxed out at sort of 80 or 100. So it was, in that context, it was very easy to find 80 or 100 people who might come to something, and actually it meant that you were less tied to crowd pleasers and more able to be adventurous. And likewise, the using of shorter concerts. So this is something that a lot of people are doing, obviously, to avoid people having an interval and needing refreshments and so on and so forth. The doing of shorter concerts also has programming implications, perhaps makes it easier to include a wider range of music if you're doing more shorter performances, or, you know. So I think there's definitely something to be said there for embracing the challenges that this brings up.
I went to a lovely concert the other day by the City of London Sinfonia in Southwark Cathedral, and they had the performers standing, I suppose, in the place that they would ordinarily be playing, but for the audience they'd put out various chairs socially distanced around the cathedral. And then the other tickets, you could just walk around the cathedral at your leisure. And people were really good at kind of self-policing and working out where they could go. And it was a reduced capacity. But I think you're right. I've seen a lot of shorter concerts, and also organisations programming, say, a 1 hour concert at 4 o'clock and then repeating it at, say, 7 o'clock. So I guess we need to get enough people through the door to make enough money, especially because venues aren't able to charge for refreshments.
Yeah.
But I definitely think there are a lot of possibilities for how we could reimagine this.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the there's already becoming a new traditional, isn't there, with the sort of something like 4 o'clock and 7 o'clock 1 hour concerts, which is, again, maybe this just feels like it to me because I'm involved in so many different musical events, but this feels to be the new format. This is the, like, the new 7:30. But I already love that because going to a concert at 4 o'clock is completely different from going to a concert at 7:30. There are so many reasons why you might be able to do that, where you might not be able to go at 7:30.
Yeah, I'm such a fan of the 1 hour concert. And especially if you say go at 7 o'clock, you've still got time to go for dinner afterwards. So it's, I mean, really nice to slot it into your life doing lots of other different things.
Exactly. The conundrum of when to eat has been
exactly
a nightmare,
yeah,
forever. And then
exactly
for audience members it's bad enough, but for artists, I mean, really, like, the number of artist dinners that I've been to that don't even start until gone 10 p.m. and I'm just like, oh, you know. It's a punishing time of night to have
I'm
your dinner.
Always pre-COVID, I was constantly scoffing a sandwich on the tube on the way to a 7:30 event.
Exactly.
So maybe that's the end of that, but we'll see.
Maybe. I remember once my husband and I went to the Vienna State Opera when we were in when we were on holiday in Vienna years and years ago. We had a takeaway kebab on the way. Yeah. So we're like, ah, we've got no time.
Classic. Like, yeah.
We're so traditional.
But it is very interesting. I totally agree that there are lots of people I speak to now who are so well versed in alternative ways of thinking about classical music, and it can be easy to forget that it is still very innovative in a lot of circles. And I think on a past episode, one of your guests was mentioning that it's like a mass of shit turning around, or an oil tank turning around.
It's oil tanker. Yeah.
I enjoyed that analogy. That's very true. It's a genre that has hundreds and hundreds of years of history behind it. So it might be slow to change. And I know that alternative ways of presenting classical music have been talked about for a long time, and lots of interesting events have been happening for a long time. But there is a lot out there. So I think it's growing, but it's true that it's kind of hard to tell in the grand scheme of things.
The online side of things is a whole new, it's not even one way of doing alternative events either, is it? It's online events. I've seen such an enormous range of online versions of classical music events. You know, you can do, you know, you can film a concert, you can live stream it, you can pre-record it, you can make a film. I saw one that had an architect had designed a background, so all the players looked as though they were playing in sort of a big open house next to a lake, you know, that, and there'd been design artistry in that, which is lovely, you know, to combine art forms like that. It's always a joy to see these things being done. I just feel as though to come back to the question you raised before as to whether it was going to be traditional or alternative, or obviously, you know, hopefully a combination of both in one way or another, but what combination going forward? But I do think we've seen some fantastic innovation in online events.
I think it's definitely been beneficial to have a bit of a pause in terms of being able to have the freedom to think about doing things online, because, for example, all of that technology was available before. But it's just that we didn't really have the time, the headspace, the inclination, the funds to think about really embracing that fully. And now that it's the only option available, people have really learned how to do that and embraced it.
Absolutely. And I think, I mean, we've been forced into it, haven't we, by circumstances, but actually, and you know, people in classical music, I don't know if you would agree with this, but in my experience, it is very driven by history, as we've said before. Certainly in some of the organizations that I work with, we're absolutely obsessed with talking about what our audiences will and won't do, but we've never actually challenged them to find out whether they will or won't do other things. I had to go through with one of my clients, I went through literally months of committee meetings discussing whether to hold the concerts on a Saturday or a Thursday. At one point, I suggested changing it up even between, and that was just, whoo, no, too much. So it is glacial at times, the change. But now that I think about it, you know, literally just before lockdown happened, I was writing this big funding application for one of my clients who's doing a really great kind of push to get their chamber music concerts really inclusive. This is whole chamber music, and it's very close to my heart, this project, because it's my project and I'm proud of it. But we did a pilot event where we did an inclusive, relaxed concert. You know, the day after our sort of normal traditional Thursday evening concert, and the idea was basically that obviously if you were any of the many different people who can't come on a Thursday evening for whatever reason, whether it's cost, ability, childcare responsibilities, whatever, that you could come and do it in this space. And it was really successful. And my plan and was and still is to not just to do the odd one of these, but to actually make that something that is entirely parallel with the main series, so that it's not, because you know, as a mum, I've noticed that if I want to take my son to a concert in a festival, I have to like peruse the brochure closely to find like the one event that's deemed suitable for that. And I quite like the idea of an event series being literally, you will be able to see all the artists, you will be able to see probably all the music, depending on, you know, some of the concerts would be the same program, some wouldn't, etc. You know, it's sort of all bespoke. But you know, that anyway, this was the bid that I was writing in February, and then COVID happened and lockdown happened, and obviously we're now revising these plans a bit, and that in the form that I've imagined it won't happen this year. But online my concerts are so accessible. If I want to, if my son has watched more music from the Wigmore Hall in the last few months, well, than he ever will in the next decade, probably. And I just think it hadn't crossed any of our minds that as part of a project directly aiming to be more inclusive, that we should consider the internet in that. So you know, in a sense, I'm glad that we've been forced to think like this.
Yeah, I have really mixed views about all the online stuff. I suppose from the perspective of me being a digital consultant, I'm very excited that everyone is learning these skills and trying it out and mixing it up and, you know, dreaming of different ways of presenting it. Because perhaps before lockdown, classical music was a little bit behind digitally. And I do lots of work in trying to represent it more on social media and bring these ideas to more people through the internet. But on the other hand, I don't know if we've completely cracked this model yet.
No.
Because as far as I've seen, most online streams haven't been charged. They haven't been had ticket costs associated. So it's not necessarily sustainable. But I have seen some really lovely concerts that people have been putting on and charging for tickets. And you can also send through your the piece that you'd like to hear, and everyone is kind of having the same cocktail together. And some people are having lots of success with selling all their tickets. But it's how we do that on a larger scale. That's probably it's quite a big question.
Yeah, no, I completely agree. I think industry potentially missed a trick at the beginning by being so generous and pushing everything out for free, and I completely understand why that happened, but I'm not sure that any favours were done to the musicians that are now currently out of work and without any particular promise of being able to make any money online. I'm attempting to do projects with online paywalled concerts, and I don't have any idea yet or any real model as to whether it's going to be successful. I do genuinely believe there's value in it. I think that people, I think that it's definitely possible to create an online experience that's worth paying for. And I don't think it needs to be an all singing, all dancing, massive film of a whole opera that involved 400 people to create to be worth that either. I think it can be, you know, intimate and beautiful and filmed in someone's living room and have value. So yeah, I completely agree with you in that, in feeling that the industry has not cracked how to make online a viable sort of part of it. But yeah, it's certainly a work in progress.
Yeah, I think there's definitely there's definitely pros and cons. I think one really lovely thing about it has been that in a way it makes classical music so accessible, because you're literally seeing a musician in their living room talking to you, where maybe the internet's not working very well, or it's just very much like you're on the same level. And I suppose in a concert hall setting, that you do not have that kind of, you've got much more of a separation. Because of the stage and just all the traditions around it. So I think that's a really nice way of feeling close to the musicians. But equally, personally, I haven't been that interested in going to online events, just partly because I do all of my work is online, and I'm spending a lot of time on Zoom and just being on the screen generally. So that's quite a hard one. And then also you've got the aspect, you've got to think about the fact that Amazon Prime and Netflix and iPlayer are also your competition now. So if someone's going to watch something online, are they going to go for the opera or are they going to go for their favourite TV series? I think there's definitely a mix. And I've been thinking about it a little bit like what the process that the newspapers went through, where they started putting everything online. And now they've had to create paywalls. So it might be interesting. I suppose we're just a little bit behind on that. So we'll see how it develops.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, there are parallels. Another parallel that someone drew with me, with online music needs to find its place. It's like when radio started, or televised music. I mean, television in general, but you know, I think radio is a good analogy. You know, there probably, I mean, I don't know, I mean, there wasn't a place for that. You know, the way we listen to the radio is not the same as the way we attend concerts. So it's now like there's also this other thing. In some ways, online music is more like radio or TV.
I suppose what's a fantastic part of going to a concert is being in that bubble for an hour or 2 hours or however long you're there, and you concentrate and all you're thinking about is the music, and that is a lovely space to be in. And if I'm listening to the radio, I'm definitely pottering about or replying to emails or calling someone up or doing a lot of other things, and I think especially during lockdown it would be lovely. I mean, ironically it's the time that we cannot access this on the whole, but it would be lovely to just go and sit in a concert hall for 2 hours and just be taken away by the music, whereas now it feels like we've always got notifications coming in of bad news, and seeing what the latest announcement is from the government and what's happening on Twitter and all of these things.
Yeah, exactly. It's all kind of muddled up together, which is not it doesn't create that like safe meditative space.
Exactly. So and I think that is sometimes seen as I don't know, perhaps criticism is too strong a word to use, but I think there's a worry from some people who've never been to some of these alternative events, that people going to them therefore are not listening in the same way, and they're not entering into that sacred space. And I think that can be true, but from a lot of the events that I've been to, that certainly is not true. So, for example, non-classical, who I mentioned earlier, when we're putting on music in the back room of a pub in Dalston, actually, I mean, everyone is chatting away, but as soon as the music starts, everyone is very much just listening, concentrating, enjoying the music. And it is interesting that people choose to do that, even though it's not necessarily, it's not what you'd necessarily do at any other kind of gig of any other genre.
I went to a really great wedding last year with a friend of mine who's a musician, and it was one, I don't know if your friends do this, my friends tend to have weddings / concerts. And he got this fab string quartet to play while we were all having a drink, you know, when you sort of first arrived at the reception venue like you often do. And I mean, they were amazing musicians, and the room was absolutely full of musicians. So maybe this is why this happened, I don't know, but we all just sat and watched them the whole time, you know. It was just like,
we weren't
going to chat through that.
Yeah. One of my friends, this is a slight tangent, but one of my friends just told me that her friend got married and the congregational audience performed Spem in Allium, as in they had enough singers that they could do a 40-part piece of choral music with everyone involved. It just sounds, I wish I'd been there.
That's very Muto, isn't it? Yeah. It sounds incredible. Yeah. Goals. Lovely. So I've got another thing I'd like to talk with you about then, which we've sort of touched on already, which is about the impact of all of this on what's going to still be around in the future. We've mentioned already that you know, we've talked about maybe whether it'll be more traditional, more alternative, a combination of the two, but further than that, you know, we have to look at the way jobs are going, the way music organisations are adapting or not, and whether they'll survive, and the way whether artists will be able to survive being an artist, in the way, in what that means at the moment, which at the time of recording this podcast on the 7th of October, still many haven't worked for over 6 months. And yeah, I think that we've got some concerns, haven't we, about the future of people working in the industry and sort of who that might be.
Yeah, it's obviously a really scary, really scary time at the moment. I have concerns that the people that will be able to remain in the industry are the people that have the people that are perhaps right at the very top of their careers. And it will be the people that are able to financially, and that might exclude some people that are either beginning their careers or midway through their careers, or who don't have the kind of financial support to be able to do that. And therefore, perhaps the industry will become less inclusive rather than more, which is what we've all been working towards for so many years, to make it more inclusive.
Yeah, exactly. So, I mean, obviously, it costs a fortune to become a professional musician. I mean, a real fortune, years and years and years, decades, in fact, of you know, one-to-one lessons with experts in your field, at least one very expensive degree, and a whole load of financial help, usually from family, not always, obviously, but that's like, and the vast majority of people tend to have come from wealthier backgrounds. And I actually think the same is true in arts admin, or certainly similarly true. Arts admin, low level, kind of entry level jobs, require a great deal of expertise and skill and don't command huge salaries. And then the move up through, I don't know if this is your experience, my experience of moving through the arts admin kind of career ladder was that it was very easy to get an entry level job in which I was paid an entry-level salary and was required to pretty much be the equivalent of a UN ambassador. to say, to be slightly flippant, but actually not really, if anyone's done one of those kind of jobs. And then when I was sort of looking to go more like a step up beyond the kind of like say 25 grand a year type mark, I just couldn't really. There wasn't anything. There was either the really top level jobs, which I didn't feel like I was ready for, or there was just more entry level jobs in something different. And I mean, that's a slight aside. That's, you know, a problem that isn't really the case anymore, because now the job market is different, sadly. But yeah, staying in that career path on either side, and obviously there's also all the freelancers that work in production and stage management and orchestra management and so on, you know, I think it's a real challenge.
Yeah, I have so many concerns about so many areas of this, and especially because paired with the fact that music education is dwindling around the UK, and I'm from a state school background, and I was really fortunate to have lessons as a child because my parents really valued it, but that probably wouldn't have otherwise been the case, and I wouldn't be here now. I actually found it very hard to get into the industry. I had my music degree and I had all of my training, and I'd had, you know, many, many, many hours since I was about 7 years old, learning all the things that I now know. But then when I was going for all these interviews, I was told again and again, you seem great, but we need you to do your 6 month internship unpaid before you can get one of these roles because you don't have enough experience. And I ended up not going into the industry at that point because I just wasn't able to financially back myself. I didn't have the support in that way. I'm not from London. So I worked in publishing for a few years before transferring over to music. So I now see that, well, hopefully that is now a really useful thing, because I think it allows me to see the industry from the outside in some ways, because it is very much a bubble. And I think the more that you get entrenched in it, it's harder to remember that you're in a bubble. But I think there are, it can be hard to come in from the outside, and preference is always given to people who've already worked in the industry, which I totally understand why that is the case. It's very understandable. But it can also be really beneficial to have some of those outside eyes and ideas coming from elsewhere that you may have learned along the way.
Well, absolutely, because if we don't have, you know, we all can only have our own perspectives, no matter how wide or informed they are, some more than others, obviously. And I think we absolutely must have other voices, more diverse voices in the industry, even than we do now. And it is better now than it probably ever has been, but or I certainly hope it is anyway. But you know, it's absolutely essential. It's something that's really, I'm really passionate about, is the representation of diversity of like people from different racial, economic, ability backgrounds and other things as well on boards, because I think this is something that is really problematic in every industry, but I think the classical music industry is really behind on this. And I've certainly you know, worked with organisations that have had absolutely no understanding whatsoever of how much they don't know because of the lack of diversity at the top level, and I've seen firsthand how a lack of understanding of people essentially at the top level feeds right the way down, say a community organisation, to the members, and people just won't join. And I also think that organisations like, say, community groups and so on, in my experience, don't do enough thinking about, they think an awful lot about the people that they have and the members that they have and other members that they might get that might be a bit like those ones, but they don't think about the people that have never shown any interest.
Yeah, I think the more that,
yeah.
Sorry,
I'd finished. I didn't think I had, but I had.
Yeah, I think the more that we're an inclusive club, the less we're going to be able to attract new diverse audiences. So I'm really, for anything I can do that will can help level the playing field, I'm here to do. I mean, it seems crazy to say this, but it's even quite a big step to, so everything I do, I make sure to include female composers as much as male composers. And that's still not,
It's not often done, is it?
it's not often
You
done, which seems like
get.
such a basic, it seems like such a basic step to take. It's really not innovative, but
Well,
within the industry, it is.
exactly. I agree. I think, and this is why, and I think you've hit the nail on the head there by saying as much as male composers. I think that there's been a step to include female composers and composers of color, and you'll get representation maybe on a disc or in a concert program, but it'll be one thing. It won't be like all the programs and at least half the things, or at least a reasonable proportion of the items or whatever. And I just think it's and I just can't believe the amount that we don't know. I mean, like I say, none of us really want to learn, that there are things that we don't know and don't understand. And I do, I think that all of us find that hard when that happens. But my colleague Margaret and I were having a conversation recently about the Black Lives Matter movement, and Margaret is 61 and has played in orchestra since I don't know, before the age of 10, and has never once played a piece of music by a black composer ever
Yeah,
in an orchestral setting.
I went through this exact shocking realization as well. So I was writing a series of articles during lockdown, and the most successful one to date, and there's still lots of people on this page every day, so it's content that people are really interested in, is 10 contemporary black composers. And whilst I was researching for that article, I think I could probably have named maybe four, and I could name hundreds of white composers. And I just found it so shocking to realize that I thought I would have known, but I could only name a few people. So this content is, it's really important. There's a playlist to go along with that. And again, that's been really popular. So
It's a fabulous playlist.
people are really interested in hearing about this, and learning more about it. And I think we all just need to, be aware of it and just educate ourselves as much as we can and just be open to hearing about it. But I can see that it's very hard for someone to have had so many years of training in the classical industry, and to think that you know so much about it, and then to realize, oh, actually, I can't think of more than a handful of black composers. I can see that that's quite a hard thing to get your head around. So it will take time for us all to evolve. But it's important work to be doing.
It is. I think that playlist is one of the things that I mean, I actually refer to it frequently and I'm working my way through it, because it's now that I know the names, I need to know the music, and that is a longer term thing
A longer
to work
term.
on.
Yeah, exactly.
And when I come to the point where I'm humming that more frequently, and I feel like I've made progress. But yeah, no, absolutely. If we can be open and willing to be wrong, then hopefully we can do some good things.
That's really
So
important, yeah.
it really is. So if you could say of, one thing maybe that you would really like to see in the future of classical music, possibly inspired by the shift, the tide that we're seeing, the tidal shift that we're seeing at the moment. What do you think we could do?
Oh, yeah, this is a big question. And it feels a difficult one when everything is so perilous at the moment. And I suppose, I mean, if it comes down to it, my wish is that classical music, the industry still exists, and that, we're all still able to make this music together and share it with each other. But I suppose thinking more specifically about it, I would love a classical music industry that is really inclusive of all kinds of voices and lots of imaginative ways of bringing classical music to as many ears as possible, and not keeping it, perhaps as in the past, it's been perhaps a fairly narrow focus in terms of this is the way that classical music is presented, this is the one okay way in which you are allowed to consume it. and just say, actually, there's so many exciting ways that we can think about presenting it, and those things will appeal to different people, and that's all well and good. And there's no sense of hierarchy in terms of, oh, so I get asked a lot, is the idea that someone will come along to one of these alternative events, and then later there'll be, it's sort of like I'm luring them in, and that at one point, you know, by the end of the journey, they will go to a full orchestral concert.
They will have been upgraded to a full level 5 classical music fan.
Yeah, soon they will be going to the Ring Cycle and they will love every moment of it. This is not at all what I am trying to do. But I get this attitude quite a lot. And I have to explain to people, I don't think there's anything about any of these concerts that I'm talking about that is in any way diluted, if we want to use that word, or dumbed down, or it's not meant to be patronising. It's just a different creative expression of the same music, and the space for all these different types. And one does not push out opportunities for any others, or it doesn't negate any other approaches. So,
absolutely. Well, I completely agree with your vision for classical music.
Thank you. We'll see how that goes.
Yes, we'll see. We'll keep ploughing on. Thank you so much for coming and talking to me today, Hannah. It's been a real pleasure.
No problem. Thank you for inviting me.
Thank you. You can read about Hannah's work. Where can you read about your work, Hannah?
So you can visit my website alternativeclassical.co.uk, or you can follow us at Alter Classical across Twitter, Facebook or Instagram.
Lovely, brilliant. Great. Thank you so much again. Goodbye.
Thank you. Bye.
Thank you so much for listening today. To find out what we're up to, do join our mailing list or follow us on social media. And if you'd like to support the podcast by buying me a coffee, you can do that on buymeacoffee.com. Thank you so much. See you next time.